Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. It's one of the strange artifacts of history that Zanzibar, the island off the coast of Tanzania, was once controlled by the Sultanate of Oman. In 1832, then-Sultan Sayyid Said bin Sultan al-Busaidi made the island his capital, with the empire later split in two upon his death, one based in Muscat, one based in Zanzibar. As Seema Alavi notes in her history, Sovereigns of the Sea, Omani Ambition in the Age of Empire, the Omani extended their reach across the Indian Ocean, preserving their autonomy in the age of European empire, particularly, and perhaps awkwardly, regarding the slave trade. Seema Alavi is a professor of history at Ashoka University in Sonipat, Haryana. In 2010, she was at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard as the William Bentinck Smith Fellow. She has written books on the military medical institute of India, including Muslim Cosmopolitanism in the Age of Empire from Harvard University Press. Today, Seema and I talk about Zanzibar, the slave trade, and what the Omani Sultanate tells us about the international system in the Age of Empire. So, Seema, thank you so much for coming on the show today to talk about the Omani Empire. And my first question really is kind of how large a territory are we talking about when we're talking about the, you know, the quote unquote Omani Empire? There's Oman, there's Zanzibar. Where else are we talking about?
Yes, I mean, thank you for having me. And this is one of the first interviews for my book, so I'm very excited, and I hope your audience and all of us benefit from this. So to answer your question, actually, I call it the Sultanate and not the Empire, because somewhere in my mind, I have a geographical expanse for an empire, which I think in the Omani case, it doesn't quite fit into that expanse geographically. But at its peak period in the 19th century, it was pretty expansive, you know, territorially. So it had almost, you know, the southeast corner of the Arabian Peninsula, right up to the Strait of Hormuz, then to Iran, Persia, Bandar Abbas, Kishim, some of these important ports in the Persian Gulf. And then, of course, a very long coast on the Swahili coast on East Africa, starting from, say, where Kenya is today to where Mozambique is today, right? So it's a pretty long East African coast. So, I mean, in terms of geography and territory, it was pretty expansive. Also interesting and kind of exceptional, I would say, which is why I got attracted to it, because it covered a kind of, you know, African continent. It covered the Arabian, you know, polities. It covered the Iranian coast, you know. So it was in its Afro-Arab Persian profile, it was pretty exceptional. Right. So that's why that was one of the reasons why I got excited about it, because, as you probably know, I'm a historian of South Asia, and I don't, you know, normally would not get attracted to doing a whole book on Oman. But it's this exceptional geographical character of the Sultanate interested me. And in terms of connections, of course, Bombay and India were very much part of the geographical imaginary of the Sultanate. So if you move from beyond the physical expanse of the empire to a kind of more embracive imaginary of the Sultanate, then I would say that, the western coast of India, Kutch, Bombay, they were also very much within the political ambit of the Sultanate. So in that sense, it was pretty expansive, pretty exceptional, and I thought worthy of, you know, a little more investigation.
And I mean, I know your book, I think, doesn't talk about this part of the Omani Sultanate that much. But the idea that Gwadar, in my other life, I write a lot about
China economics, and obviously Gwadar is a name that pops up a lot. And the idea that that was Omani until quite recently, actually, is also something I never realized.
Yes, yes, that's true. And I mean, there was so much of hop in, hop off, as it were, geographically, of this empire. So for Baluchistan, which is today in Pakistan, at different points of time, was very much within their ambit. So many ports, Gwadar, Keshem, Bandar Abbas, were on lease to the Omani sultans. It was not only was it exciting for me because it was Afro-Arab Persian in its profile, but it was also exciting to me because of the waxing and waning of its geographical territories and the ideas of political sovereignty, invoking, drawing, deriving from so many of these waxing, waning, geographical bits that were off and on added, deleted, in the long history of the empire. So it was pretty unusual. And I was quite surprised that in the larger kind of frame and gamut of global and world history, even Indian Ocean history, nobody had kind of, paused to think of its exceptionality and what could that mean in our writing of world and global histories.
Well, let's talk about that a bit. I mean, you've already kind of mentioned this in your previous answer, especially in your wish to call it the Omani Sultanate and not the Omani Empire, because empire brings a lot of description and baggage with it. But so what is it about the Omani Sultanate that makes it important when we talk about the international system of the time? How does it challenge the way we understand things like sovereignty, like imperialism? What do we miss when we don't look at the Omani Sultanate?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. Thank you. Well, I think when I was doing the archival research for this book, one of the received wisdoms, as you know, that I had as a student and a kind of interested scholar of the Indian Ocean world, was that imperialism meant European imperialism, at least in the ocean and all its politics, especially in the age of empire in the 19th century. When you talked about imperial powers, you talked about Britain, France, Holland, and imperialism with all its baggage, as you said, and all that it connotes at different temporalities, was really a European issue. And all the concepts that derived from that word and that idea were Western and European. But I was so surprised in the archive that, that there were other imperial aspirations floating around in the Western Indian Ocean, and that these other imperial ambitions were not necessarily Western or European. They were Arab, Asian, and they were interestingly entangling, borrowing, cannibalizing ideas from European imperial powers with whom they were rubbing shoulders in the ocean. But at the same time, they were invoking their own traditions and healing themselves very firmly in their domestic constituencies. Now, what was actually very interesting was that I started thinking, of course, I was very, intrigued, because that really questioned some of the things that I, a very Western European Indian Ocean, a British lake, as it was called in the 19th century, by the 19th century. So, at one level, it started questioning all those ideas that I had of the ocean, and I got really excited. But on the other hand, I was excited that there was competition within imperial powers, and that this competition was not only within European powers, but it was between them and the Arab Asian imperial powers also. So that was something which, I wanted to pause to think about. It was something new that I had discovered. But secondly, I think it was quite exciting, and I was very excited that the reason why Europeans and Arab Asian imperialists or imperial powers were competing and borrowing from each other and whatever was because actually they were going for the same things in the ocean, or they had come to the, I mean, the ocean meant certain profits of trade, and there was a shared kind of interest in those profits of trade. And of course, you know what I'm getting at, slaves, slave trade. Most of the European powers were making a beeline to the ocean for that. The Asian and the Arab, sultans and polities were kind of equally interested in the trade, in monopolizing profits of trade. So the kind of rubbing shoulders of imperial powers, the shared kind of interests, the borrowings, the kind of invocations of traditional domestic, reference of power and sovereignty, and yet the entanglement and the engagement with European ideas. I think all of that was possible because the interests, the economic, commercial interests were the same. Now, the languages in which these interests were being articulated were obviously not the same. They were different. But at the bottom of this shared, space kind of at times bonhomie, at times antagonism, at times entanglement, at times distancing, was that everybody was going for the same things. So I think in that context, it is interesting that Arab Asian imperialists also need to be introduced in the story of European imperial expansion of European imperialism in the Indian Ocean, because it makes them out not as unsuspecting victims, and it makes the story of the European hegemony and monopolization of the ocean, especially the British kind of dominance of the ocean, it kind of makes that narrative a little more complex and complicated.
So let's talk about kind of what these places were like. I want to bring up Zanzibar first. Okay, kind of. So, what exactly was the place of Zanzibar like during the period you're writing about? I note that I think you quote Dr. Livingston, who's quite rude about it, or at least quite rude about the city.
Yes.
So what actually is this? Was this part of the world like at that time?
Yes. Yeah, so I think I think that, it was really initially a Portuguese kind of settlement and island until all through the 16th century. And in whatever records I saw, it was really around the 17th century, 1690s, that one of the Omani prince, I think Saif Ahmed, if I'm not mistaken, Saif bin Sultan, he actually took a kind of campaign there, and he defeated the Portuguese and he set foothold on Zanzibar. So around 1698, 17th century, that's when, the Omani political foothold and presence in Zanzibar begins to look very real and visible. Although I must add that prior to this, even when it was a Portuguese kind of settlement, the commercial and trading links, I think, were still intact, between the eastern coast of Africa and the Arabian, southeast corner of the Arabian Peninsula. But I think from the 17th century, I think you can see a kind of political investment, interest, and a political, Omani political foothold in Zanzibar. And I think that this interest, this political investment and interest only increased through the 18th and into the 19th century. And my understanding is that one of the reasons why it increased is that, from the late 18th and early 19th century, as the British surveillance control of the slave trade And even before this kind of abolitionist rhetoric, you know, kind of intensified or became shrill in the middle of the 19th century, even in the early part of the century, like, you know, before, like, say, before the first slave ban treaty was signed by the Omanis and British in 1820, just before that, this kind of British surveillance, control, interference in the Western Indian Ocean, taking slave trade as their point of entry, that had really kind of become a nuisance for the Omani sultans. And my sense is from the records that they really wanted to open up other kinds of ports and other kinds of, you know, geographical spaces where they could function, carry on with their trade and their profits and their, you know, slave depots and all of that, with relatively less British surveillance and relatively less generally European competition also, I think. And I think that's why through the 18th century, and especially before the 1820-21 treaty with Britain about slave ban, which of course never really, I mean, did not really materialize into anything effective on ground, you find that Zanzibar becomes of great political interest, a place of political investment for the Omanis, primarily, I think, because my understanding is that they are looking for kind of quote-unquote safe havens, you know, away from British surveillance and British interference and control. I think, so the Muscat trade, they want to kind of, you know, lie low on and open up new areas from where they can function. And I think that, you know, from the 1820s, when Sayyid Said, who's one of the most important, you know, patriarch of the Sultanate, he really begins to invest money also into Zanzibar. And because he really thinks that this is his kind of solution to the kind of ways he's being almost enveloped by Britain and other European powers. And he makes large investments in clove plantations, for instance. He's the one who actually starts this clove plantation business in Zanzibar. And he's the one who is very encouraging of Indian merchants and wants Indian merchants and bankers to invest in land and in clove plantations. In fact, Indian merchants and bankers are actually his main investors. They are rolling money into, you know, the economy of Zanzibar. And by 1850s, I saw a kind of, you know, an estimate of the income, annual income that is being generated under Sayyid Said's regime and his interest, both political and commercial, economic. And I was actually really surprised that the annual income of Zanzibar by 1850 exceeded $100,000, you know, and this was like a huge jump from pre-1820s, you know, days in Zanzibar, when, you know, before the Omanis and Sayyid Said in particular had not really focused on it as an alternate site for his political and his commercial entrepreneurship. So slaves, ivory, cloves, bankrolled almost by Indian capital, Indian bankers, merchants, you know, really became a new kind, I would say, a new kind of political economy of Zanzibar under Omani aegis almost. I was actually so enthused and thrilled because under the cover of this, you know, more commercial economic investments that Sayyid Said was making in Zanzibar, which were bearing fruits, as I said, you know, because the annual incomes were jumping from their earlier records. You also, I mean, this was also a way to tease the British. You know, it was also a way to kind of, you know, pull the rug from under their feet, in the sense that most of the English merchants, bankers who he was attracting and who were his major financiers were British Indian subjects. A lot of them, you know, they were British Indian subjects. It is true that a lot of them were from the independent Western Indian state of Kutch in modern Gujarat today, and they were independent, and they were kind of under their own Rao of Kutch, their own ruler. Nonetheless, we should not forget the kind of agency that, you know, these kind of conflictual and contesting gray zones of whose subjects you are, you know, offers to individuals. And Kutchi merchants and generally merchants from the western coast of India who were very much active and involved, both Hindus and Muslims, by the way, Khojas and Hindu Kutchi merchants from the western coast of India, sometimes, you know, got their way through as British Indian subjects when it suited them. When it did not suit them, they said, we are not British Indian subjects. We are the subjects of the Rao of Kutch, and so on and so forth. So they played with this, you know, this interesting moment in Omani history, with Zanzibar opening up, or you know, with their help. So I think that Zanzibar, quite contrary to the rude comments of Livingston, in the 19th century, seemed to me, in the early 19th century records, in especially Sayyid Said's period, as an extremely vivacious, thriving, bustling port town, in which, you know, very good couriers could be made. And these couriers that were made were across ethnic, you know, groups. Of course, even now, if you go to Zanzibar, some of the most, I don't know if you've been there, but well, you should, some of the most striking architectural buildings along the coast are merchant houses, and they are made by Indian Kutchi merchants or Khoja merchants from Gujarat, they were some of the wealthiest people. But apart from that, I think that some of the important Swahili slavers and merchants also benefited from this, you know, very politically motivated boom time that Sayyid Said inaugurated in Zanzibar. And so, contrary to Livingston, as I said, it was a place of opportunities for across ethnic groups, for Swahilis, for Indians, for Arab merchants and slavers, and interestingly, also for British private merchants and British private merchant companies. And I think I have some examples in the book where, you know, I give examples of how, you know, many of the British private interests in trade were tying up with Kutchi, with Arab interests, and things like, you know, sugarcane pressing machines and stuff were being introduced via those collaborations. So, yeah, I mean, so Livingstone might say rude things, but I think there was a reason, there was a different reason why he was saying rude things. But in terms of actual political and commercial visibility, it was boom time, to answer your question more specifically. Yeah.
Well, let's maybe pivot to talk about, and there was lots of stuff there that I would like to get into, but I would like to pivot to talk about domestic politics, which could also be a euphemism, I guess, for royal politics. You know, I think the Sultanate gets split in two. You have Zanzibar, and you have then Muscat in Oman. So the Sultanate gets split in two between the two brothers. I'm also struck was that there was the story of I believe you write it was a daughter in the Zanzibar court who escapes and runs away to marry some European merchant, which is very embarrassing, I think, for everyone involved. But how does the Omani kind of sultan, like, I guess the royal court, and those politics kind of influence the development of this sultanate?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you. So yeah, I mean, I think one of the ways in which you had a question somewhere that, you know, how did Sayyid Said manage his empire, or how did he go about it? And so I think what I'm saying might cover that, which is that one of the ways in which I think notions of sovereignty and running a sultanate, the Omani style, differed from, I think, some of its peer and contemporary European, ways of handling things, was that the family and the household remained central to politics. And even when I do my Indian history bits, I feel that sometimes that quite contrary to the stereotypes that we have between the West and the rest about the position of women and household and family and all of that, as far as history tells us, in terms of political culture, politics, the divide between the private and the public in non-European polities is far blurred than it seems to me the case, with the Western polities. So having said that, one of the other things which struck me as a South Asianist working on getting excited about the Omani Sultanate was that although it seemed from the, when I started researching on it, it was Sayyid Said, who kind of interested me, and he was like this big patriarch and everything was happening under his aegis and all of that. But when I probed more, it seemed that, yes, he was the big overarching patriarch, but it was the family and the household which was central to his politics. So this runaway princess who marries this German merchant and then settles somewhere in Germany, I don't think it's an aberration. Although, because her memoirs got written and they got translated into English and European languages, I think she is very popular and she kind of sticks out as a kind of aberration in this otherwise very patriarchal, setting and all of that. But if you look at Sayyid Said's politics, Sayyid Said himself had several wives and many concubines, and and they were from different parts of the world, almost different parts of the Indian Ocean. They were from Ethiopia, Abyssinia. There was one from Malabar, all kinds of Central Asian places, Georgia. It's interesting that the different princes and sons of Sayyid Said were offsprings of different ladies in his court, in his household. And it seems when I was researching them that this harem politics was very interesting or very influential in determining the careers and fates of these princes. So they would jostle and lobby for support of their respective sons for good postings as governors of Zanzibar or wherever. The princes themselves, their training to be sultans or then to take on these, roles, in that training, the women also played a very important role. Further, I think that I found some interesting information. And when I went to Zanzibar, I saw some of the architectural material remnants of that, which is that and this kind of interest that Sayyid Said had in Bandar Abbas on the Persian side of the, Persian Gulf, and Kishim and these ports and islands for his, for carrying on, I believe, a kind of commercial and trading, experiment with relatively less surveillance. For that also, you know, he was entering into matrimonial alliances with Persian princesses. One of them was very important, and she came back with him to Zanzibar. And in Zanzibar, I saw a Persian bath that he had built for her. And that was like, you know, I was very excited to see that because it was unexpected. You know, I was just driving past some very beautiful clove plantations. And suddenly I saw, you know, these kind of very Indo-Persian kind of domes sticking out from behind the clove trees. And since I'm trained as a South Asianist, of course, that kind of architecture, you know, kind of attracts my eye. And I said, oh, God, what is this in Zanzibar? And I asked my driver to take a detour. And he just was dismissing it. And he said, oh, there's nothing. I'm taking you to the palace, you know, and whatever. I said, no, please, I just want to have a look. And there was this Persian bath. And there was a Persian, in Persian, there was a little, you know, a kind of detail there. And which said, what I had read in some of the records, that Sayyid Said had built this Persian bath for his Persian princess, his wife, her queen. So what I was saying is that the queens, the princess, the women, the household, the family was extremely integral to his politics. There were very interesting details about what the marriage with this princess, Persian princess, meant to his control over slave traffic from that part of the Persian Gulf, and you know, all of that. So basically, the kind of contestations that, for instance, he was having with the British about surveillance control, slave trade, slave traffic, postings of his sons for various, you know, like political reasons to different parts of his sultanate, to a large extent, women were calling the shots from behind. And they were playing a very critical role. The private and the public or political was pretty much fused, you know, in the Omani Sultanate. Of course, as we all know, as social scientists, that gave a lot of agency to women in the Sultanate. These large extended families. It's interesting that I'm forgetting the name of this princess, but who ran away, who you mentioned. But she was the sister of Sayyid Majid, you know, one of the Sultan's son. And if I remember correctly, she fell in love with this German merchant because she was living in Zanzibar with her brother, you know, Majid, and she was not in Muscat. If you read her memoir and all, I mean, yes, it was a kind of scandal in the town, but in terms of actual action being taken by Majid, you must have noticed that there wasn't that much, you know? I mean, after all, he was the Sultan. He could have dragged her back. He could have done all kinds of things. But it was interesting that it was not such a kind of violent response.
It just seems more.
And I think that's because it's part of a long history of women calling the shots in the Sultanate.
Yeah, it seems it's a lot more kind of like just aggrieved and embarrassed as opposed to.
Yes. Yes.
So.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of like.
No,
go ahead.
No, I was just saying that also because I now remember, now that you mentioned, I remember reading her memoir, and I also remember going to that palace where she lived in Zanzibar, and there are all her pictures and her various room and all of that is there. And the embarrassment is also because I think, at least from the memoir, it appears that a lot of relatives are coming from Muscat, you know, and saying, oh God, what has happened? How did you allow this to happen? You know, so the embarrassment is all about, you know, within the family from relatives coming from Oman and saying all of that. But within Zanzibar, I think it was a relatively more cosmopolitan society where I don't think created so much of a stir. The stir was more from Muscat side.
Yeah. So I I do have to ask this question because the topic of slavery has come up a couple times now, which does lead to this very, I think, kind of it's like an uneasy tension, I would say, which is, it seems like the strongest example of how the Omani Sultanate could kind of preserve their autonomy and the place that they were most aggressive in trying to preserve their autonomy is regarding the slave trade. And preserving the slave trade, especially as the British Empire becomes much more abolitionist. You know, how do we then, and, you know, obviously this has echoes of what we talk about today, which is kind of the balance between national sovereignty and anti-imperialism with the concept of universal human rights. That's not to say the British at the time were concerned about that, but there are kind of, it does feel like there are echoes. How do you kind of see the Omani Sultanate? Well, first of all, like, how did the Omani Sultanate, just from the facts, how did they try to preserve their autonomy when it came to the slave trade? And then how does that kind of fit with the way we understand these all of these concepts today?
Yeah, right. Great question. Well, let me say that, and I think I make this, you want to add something?
No. Please go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think that, as I say in the book, that, well, despite all the anti-slave trade rhetoric and even the abolition discourse, abolitionist discourse in the late 19th century, I mean, I think that there was a shared interest in profits from this continuing to flow, unfortunately, from both sides, right?
Right.
And I mean, this is my understanding from the records. And there were friendships, there was bonhomie, there was kind of tie-ups at the local level, and there was lip service, I think, both from the side of the sultans as well as from the abolitionists. I mean, a lot of abolitionists, as you know, were slavers themselves, and they had so much at stake. Having said that, still, I think my take would be that the sultans were as much into political rhetoric as the British were and in this period. And I think that's why they both got along really well and both continued to profit from this horrible trade. So the question is that what is the difference in the political rhetoric, you know, of the British and the sultans? And my sense is that slave trade was, well, I wouldn't say justified or some, although I do use that word off and on in the book, but I think it was explained, let's say, like that, put it like that, by the sultans as being different from the trade against which the British were, you know, kind of raising their pitch. And continuously from Sayyid Said down to Barghash, who's, by the way, my favorite sultan, from Sayyid Said to Barghash, there is an attempt at every level, whether it is at the level of negotiations for slave treaties, whether it is emissaries being sent to London by the sultans to argue their cases. At every level, there is a kind of, through the 19th century, an attempt to say that you don't understand what this is in our context. That's the message, that you've got it wrong. You don't understand what it is. It's not what you think it is, right? And what it is, I mean, I'm quoting that Sayyid Said says, for us, it's an ancient institution, quote unquote. You know, he calls it an ancient institution. He says that for us, again, invoking the idea of family. For us, he's a member of our family. He's integral to us. The slave is integral to our family. Of course, Barghash articulates it much, in much cleaner and neater ways than others when he says that, I'm a father figure. My sovereignty, very much in a way like the 19th century Queen Victoria kind of sovereignty, mother figure. So he invokes that father figure idea. So that's why I say that they borrow a lot, you know, from their contemporary European models of how sovereignty is being articulated. So Barghash says, I'm the father figure. A father is a protector of everyone, including slaves. My kingdom is my family, and slaves are part of the family. And so I am their protector. And so this is our understanding of a slave as slaves and their relationship to, you know, our polity. And therefore, you've got it wrong. And so it's not as obnoxious and exploitative as you think it is. So, of course, this is their political rhetoric. And I'm not saying that this political rhetoric is accepted. But what I'm saying is that it jostles with the British rhetoric on slaves. With very little actual, you know, efforts to stop this trade for the variety of reasons that I've just mentioned. So despite negotiations, treaties, meetings, emissaries, back and forth, it never really stops, as we all know, you know. I think that there is a kind of turning a blind eye, even when you have agreed according to the terms of treaties like the Treaty of 1851, 1842, 51, that, you know, you will not export slaves. There is a way out in which that then begins to justify the sultan's use of slaves in their own estates, you know, in their own plantations, that, okay, we will not export, but we will, that you don't say, but, you know, because our relationship with slaves is a very family relationship, we will continue to use them in our plantations. In fact, that links to the question you asked about Zanzibar's economy. And I think one of the reasons why the Zanzibar economy really flourishes in this period of high political rhetoric about slave trade is because several treaties have been signed by the middle of the 19th century, the terms of which are that the sultans will stop the export of trade from their ports. But they say nothing about the internal movement of slaves and use of slaves within the territories of the sultan. So obviously, a lot of labor is available now to be used on clove and date plantations in Oman. And so that really benefits its economy hugely. I think that this is the way they handle it. This is the way everyone profits from it, unfortunately. And that's why I think it just goes on, despite the surface noise.
So that was going to be my last question. But actually, you mentioned something in your answer that I just have to follow up on. You called Sultan Barghash your favorite sultan. Why yes. Is that?
Yes. Well, for a variety of reasons, one of which is, of course, that he is the one who heals himself most deeply into local Omani political and cultural traditions. And while doing that, he is the one who is... who makes the most effort to get global visibility for himself. So this is one of the interesting, case in point, where an Omani sultan wants a global presence with other European imperial powers. So he wants to be on the table when the slave ratification treaty is being signed in London, in 1890s, I think. He wants to be a part of that discussion. And he does go to London, you know, and there are beautiful pictures, with some of which I have used in my book, of his visit to London to meet Queen Victoria, to meet other kinds of, you know, elites, and goes to Birmingham and London. And then he takes he's obviously traveling by ship and he stops in Paris and he, this is his nice kind of European tour, you know, for, but his, the main purpose of his visit is, you know, to kind of take part in the deliberations of the trade ratification treaty. Then it's interesting that he has been to Bombay, where he has been very friendly with the governor of Bombay, Elphinstone. And he is so influenced, you know, by the redrawing of Bombay in the late 19th century, you know, in terms of redrawing the city and its layout, because cholera is kind of ravaging the Western Indian Ocean port cities, including Bombay, that when he comes back, he's so influenced by this British colonial city that he begins to remodel, you know, parts of Zanzibar on, you know, Bombay's lines. So he lays out electrical lines, canals, irrigation things. So, I mean, it's very clear that he's really influenced by this Bombay connection. I mean, Sayed Majid also is. And as I say in the book, that, of course, I was very surprised to find this lovely file in the Zanzibar archives where, you know, Dar es Salaam was completely, a city completely modeled on Bombay because of Sayed Majid's trips to Bombay on the invitation of the governor of Bombay, Elphinstone. So Majid was also doing it, but I would say Barghash took this thing to its peak, you know, of borrowing, cannibalizing, using, you know, not just domesticating things that he liked in terms of architectural designs or in terms of, you know, infrastructural things like canals and electricity and all of that. Kind of using that as bargain counters to bargain for certain concessions, find a place for himself on the table, rubbing shoulders with other, you know, like British and other imperial powers, deliberating issues of slave trade, slavery, even Wahhabi threats, you know, meetings on that. He kind of, as I say somewhere, he kind of squeezes himself, you know, on this global chessboard, which we thought so far, and which seemed, as far as 19th century imperial politics is concerned, to be really a white man's club, right? So he is, he manages to squeeze himself into those drawing boards, and yet remains very, entrenched in Ibadi faith, which is the Muslim sectarian faith of, you know, this dynasty, very much embedded in Islamic law. The kind of courts he establishes are all run on Islamic legal principles, regimes. And yet, you know, he wants to rub shoulders with Queen Victoria and her entourage get himself photographed and clicked and, you know, be part of that imperial world and have a place in that global world, which has very few of these characters in the 19th century. So that's why I just find his politics extremely ingenious and interesting.
Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Seema Alavi, author of Sovereigns of the Sea, Omani Ambition in the Age of Empire. Seema, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all of your work. And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Thank you so much, Nicholas. So, this book, I was told by Penguin India, should be available abroad, which means outside India, by the end of this month. So, in a paperback version, so which would be cheaper and easier to read and carry. So end of September, it's being paperback copies would be available globally. But for my other works, well, as I mean, I hate to say it, but the good old Amazon .in or .uk or wherever people are is the best. I think it has all my books. I have often checked it. As far as what next? Yes, that's a good question. I've been interested for a very long time in the histories of food. And now with my foray into the Indian Ocean, I would be interested in, you know, teasing out the history of food across the ocean as it kind of, you know, moved, as ingredients moved across the ocean, what happened to recipes and cookbooks and, you know, cooks, and did they also move and stuff like that. So, you know, it's still very kind of half-baked and I'm still thinking about it. But yes, food histories across the Indian Ocean, especially the Western Indian Ocean, because that makes me, you know, keep my kind of heels dug in western coast of India, seems to be interesting me increasingly. So let's see how far we go with that.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRigordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We are on all your favorite podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more news and who's coming up on the show next week. But before then, Seema, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure and really enjoyed this conversation. I hope your audience enjoys it as well. Thank you so much, Nicholas.